You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Okay, well, good morning, everyone. My name is Lawrence Chandy. I'm a fellow here in the Global Economy and Development Program. We're here today to talk about the impact of digital technologies on development. This follows the launch of the World Bank's new World Development Report, which I assume you've all read from front to back. It's only a few hundred pages long. It's actually a wonderful report. We have one of the co-editors of the report here, as well as an expert panel to discuss it. You know, when I was back at graduate school, I remember my professors telling me how important these, the World Development Reports were, and encouraging me to read them. And when I think about the most powerful ones, the ones which have left an impression on me, they include ones such as, I think, the 2004 WDR on service delivery, the 2011 WDR on conflict. And I think what they have in common with this WDR is that they provide a way for the reader to understand a complex issue in terms of what are the drivers, what's the impact, what are the risks, and so forth. But these are all quite complex issues which the development community had sort of struggled to deal with, struggled to talk about with a similar language and not just to speak past each other. And I think this most recent WDR certainly meets that standard. Just before I introduce Deepak, who's going to provide a short presentation summarizing the report, I wanted to provide one short anecdote about the impact of digital technologies. So, a decade ago, I was living in Papua New Guinea, and it's a wonderful country which has a pretty poor development record. And I remember watching a documentary when I was there with footage of the highlands of Papua New Guinea in the 1970s, around the time of the country's independence. And apart from the grainy footage, I would watch this video, and there was nothing about the video which told me that it wasn't filmed, today, right, or a decade ago. People were wearing secondhand clothes which had been sent from Western markets. Everything looked the same. The houses looked the same. The streets looked the same. The billboards looked the same. I went back to Papua New Guinea 4 years ago, and the place had changed. Everyone had a cell phone. There was mobile money. There were other uses of cell phones. What I don't know is exactly what that means. How does that exactly change lives? I'm not entirely sure, but for me, it was the first sense that something had fundamentally changed in a country where really very little was changing at all. And I hope what we will uncover today is exactly how life might have changed for in the highlands of Papua New Guinea, and how it might change more with the impact of digital technologies. So with that, Deepak Mishra is going to come up on stage, provide a 15 or 20-minute presentation on the report. And then we'll have a panel discussion. So Deepak, please come up.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you all, and especially Brookings, for giving us the opportunity to discuss the World Development Report on Digital Dividends. Let me begin with the picture that you see on the TV screen, which captures the very essence of the World Development Report, how rapidly digital revolution has spread around the world and to what extent people will go to be part of it. This photo, taken off the coast of the Horn of Africa, shows migrants from Somalia crowding the night shores of Djibouti. And if you're wondering why are they holding the cell phone into the air, you'll have to read the full WDR. Or if you want to spare the agony of not reading the 330 pages, then listen to the presentation, because there's a clue to it. Mobile phones have spread more rapidly than any technology before. Nearly 7 out of 10 people among the poorest 20% of the world population are now having a mobile phone. And nearly 40% of the world population are actually online. And this picture shows why. A typical day in the life of the internet involves billions of emails, videos, and searches, and so on. Behind these massive numbers lies staggering amount of data and information, and some would even say knowledge, flowing across borders seamlessly and costlessly. The digital revolution has brought many immediate private benefits, easier communication, wide range of information, considerable saving in time, and new forms of leisure. But what about broader development gains? Faster growth, more jobs, better services, which are collectively referred to as the digital dividends, similar in concept to peace dividends, demographic dividends. The report analyzes the impact from the perspective of three agents: business, people, and government. The color coding that you see here is actually maintained throughout the report. The report mentions many technology, from feature phones to smartphones, from computers to clouds, and from sensors to satellites. But this report is not about technology. It's about the impact on development. And to see the transformational impact of technology, you'll have to listen to some of the stories and meet the people that we did while writing this report. Meet Mr. Meng Hongwei. Meng owns a ranch in Shandong province in China. Meng trades in live animals on Alibaba's digital platform. And his annual revenue is close to $50,000, which is a hefty increase from the $200 monthly disability benefit he used to have before. And Meng proudly says, "I'm not a disabled man, I'm an online businessman." Alibaba has 8 million online entrepreneurs, of which 62% are small and medium entrepreneurs like Meng, 1/3 are women, and 1% are people with disabilities. This could not have been possible without digital technology. A few years ago, a satellite passing over East Africa took pictures of many villages, including Kendu Bay near Lake Victoria. The satellite data were interpreted by freelancers working for Mechanical Turk. They studied the level of luminosity of each house, the rate at which the lights get reflected from the rooftop, which is a good predictor of poverty in Kenya because people either lived in a thatched house or a tin house or a tin roof. After verifying the information on the ground, workers from GiveDirectly sent $1,000 unconditional cash transfer to several beneficiaries via the mobile money platform called M-Pesa. Siprosa Akoth, the lady you see on the picture, a widow with 8 children, was one of the unexpected beneficiaries of this digital revolution. The previous industrial revolution had bypassed people like her, born into poverty in a remote village in a poor country. Hopefully, not the digital revolution. The children in this picture were once a victim of human trafficking, condemned to a life of destitution. Like them, nearly a billion Indians have been issued digital identification in the past 5 years. This is making it possible for the government to provide vital services to poor and vulnerable groups. Countries from Nigeria to Pakistan and Estonia to Singapore are other examples of successful use of digital ID to improve service delivery and reduce fiscal waste. And this could not have been possible without the digital technologies. Behind these compelling stories lie some pretty fascinating economics. The WDR builds on the economic literature to propose a simple framework for understanding how internet or digital technology broadly promotes development. By lowering the economic transaction cost and the social interaction cost, technologies are making three things happen. They're expanding the information base, they're lowering the information cost, and they're creating information goods. By expanding the information base, they're reducing information friction across markets, they're lessening information asymmetry between buyers and sellers, and this is promoting expanding the market for business, for workers, and for government, thereby promoting inclusion. By lowering information and coordination costs through automation, technology is making existing businesses and workers and government more productive. This is boosting efficiency. And by creating information goods, when the product and the process are entirely digitized, the marginal cost falls essentially to zero. Technology generates scale economies. This is the platform economy, the new economy that we talk about, which spawn new business models and promote innovation. The report applies this framework in the first three chapters to provide many examples of how internet benefits businesses, people, and government. This is where normally I would stop. Because everything I've said so far is what you'd find in a typical ICT report. Having established the benefits of digital technology, many have argued that it's only a matter of time before these benefits reach everyone and to everywhere. So every entrepreneur can become Meng, every person at the bottom of the billion can benefit like Siporsa, and many of the poor and disadvantaged would have access and identity just like the children on the street. But one wish, the story was that simple. Digital technology have become universal in many high and middle income countries, but the broader development gains have been elusive. Consider the following three trends. The first one shows that the growth of labor productivity, and so its growth of labor productivity, has been slowing down for the past three decades. The middle classes in many advanced economies have seen income stagnate over a long period of time, and that's the second curve, and the inverted U-shape shows the people who are between the 65 percentile and the 85 percentile of the world income, which is mostly the middle class, have really not seen their income and the wages increase significantly, which is perhaps why Piketty sold so many books. And then we expected that the democratic ideals and liberty would spread through the wires and modems and fiber optic, as Bill Clinton famously said in 1998. But what you see when you look at the last figure, the governance indicators like the share of elections, which are free and fair, has actually been falling for the last three decades. So what's really going on here? The report does not argue that these trends are because of digital technology, but wonders why they're happening in spite of them. So why have digital technology been spreading rapidly, but the digital dividends have lagged behind? And we provide two broad explanations. The first one is the obvious one. Despite rapid technology expansion in many parts of the world economy, a significant digital divide persists across countries. Out of 7.4 billion people, 6 billion do not have broadband, 4 billion do not have access to internet, and 2 billion do not own a mobile phone, and about 0.4 billion people live outside any mobile signal. Then, within each country, there's a significant digital access gap across gender, income, age, and geography. So there is a large unfinished agenda to make internet access universal and affordable. But as Jonathan Book would say, what happens after access? So even if we solve the access problem, technology is not neutral in its impact. Among those who have access, the benefits tend to flow disproportionately to the better off, more educated and better connected, and that's pretty normal, and that's what we should have expected from basic principle economics. So in technical terms, digital technology are productivity bias, so more productive firms use technology more intensively than less productive firms. It's skills bias, countries with more skilled people have more digital jobs, and it is voice bias in the sense more accountable and honest governments tend to be more enthusiastic adopter of digital technology. So technologies are likely to accentuate the analog inequities rather than eliminate them. And so that brings me to the second explanation of the story, is that the report argues that there are factors beyond technology that shape the development impact, and we call them the analog complements to digital development. And without those complements, the benefits will often fall short. So when you have connectivity plus complement, you get this wonderful term inclusion, efficiency, innovation. But connectivity minus complements risk leading to concentrated goods market, polarized labor market, and more state control and elite capture. So what are these complements and what to do about it? So that's another 7 minutes of the presentation. So the ICT, so let's begin with a growth story and the business story. First, we got to remind ourselves that the ICT sector itself is an important part of the economy, but it's relatively small, 4 to 5% of GDP and 1 to 2% of the labor force. Most of the growth in output and jobs will come from greater ICT adoption and not from higher ICT production. But this is not happening everywhere or at the speed at which you would have liked to see for three reasons, as illustrated in the Venn diagram here. So to the extreme right, at least from my side. The adoption of digital technology by non-ICT firm, which you call the analog economy, has been quite slow, and largely in the absence of competitive pressure in a business environment that continue to protect dominant firms and vested interest. The one in the middle, where the digital and analog firms are competing for the same product, there is uncertainty about how to regulate these sectors. So is Uber a taxi company or is it a software company? Is mobile money a telecom product or is it a banking sector product? And these are the questions that policymakers everywhere are grappling with. And on the extreme right, the economics of the internet favor natural monopolies, and we see the emergence of dominant firms in many parts of the digital economy. So far, this has generally been good for consumers. But economic history has taught us that firms are sooner or later tempted to exploit a dominant market position. So it's pretty imperative for regulators to start thinking about how do we create competition across platforms. So in summary, without good regulation, especially competition policies that ensure a level playing field for firms to connect and compete, we may see much less innovation than expected. We may instead end up seeing greater concentration and monopolies, and with divergence between firms and economies that are slow to adapt to the internet and those that have quickly come to dominate the market. Now let me turn to the people and the jobs issue. So the second risk relates to the labor market. The internet complements skills and allows workers to be more productive and to find more rewarding opportunities and higher wages. But it is also changing the labor market pretty significantly and steadily. New forms of work tend to be more informal. Automation is destroying some jobs, increasingly mid-level white-collar occupation. As this picture shows, using some of the existing methodology that has already been done for advanced economy, when we apply that methodology to a developing country, we find that two-thirds of jobs in developing countries are susceptible to computerization and automation. In general, this is a good thing because automation is how we get economic progress. But if you are one of those displaced workers, it could be pretty traumatizing and disruptive. But more important is what kind of jobs are getting increasingly automated and what does it actually mean for labor market. And a related trend is the fact that we are seeing increasing polarization of the labor market, which we had already seen in developed countries, but increasingly starting to see in developing world. The share of middle skill, middle paying occupations are increasingly automated, and so that share is falling, and many of the people who were in that middle skill are likely to go to the low-skill jobs. So the low-skill share of occupation is increasing, and the high-skill is increasing as well. This is not all due to internet. Globalization and urbanization also plays a role, but digital technology are an important driver. So as a result, the biggest risk from digital evolution is not massive unemployment, as some people would tend to say, but widening inequality and greater polarization of the labor market. And the most important public policy response is to help everyone to gain the skills that technology complements, not those that technology replaces. Now let me move to the last slide of the presentation, or in terms of the analysis. So there's been a large number of e-com initiatives. These initiatives have given us easier access to information and more efficient government procedures. But an extensive review of the evidence in the report shows that in many countries, this investment often failed to address the two most protracted challenges to improve service delivery, the one which says low and low. The accountability relationship between the service providers, the policymakers and citizens, which was the basis for the 2004 WDR, the whole principal agent problem, and we don't see systematic evidence that technology is able to overcome that. The second is the ability of citizens to participate in and influence public debate, the so-called collective action problem. There are many interesting anecdotal stories, but if you really look at systematically, you do not see dramatic impact of technology driving and overcoming collective action problem. The evidence compiled in the report suggests that initiatives that leverage technology to improve service delivery often fail when policymakers and service providers are not accountable and therefore lack a strong incentive to improve services. So now let's take all that I said to actual data and see what we find here. So what we do is, on the x-axis, we measure the extent of digital adoption by business, people, and government. So that's the digital adoption index, the more you are on the extreme right, the more technology is already being adopted in the society. On the y-axis, we measure the level of compliments. A broad summary measure of quality of regulations, skills, and institutions. And not very surprisingly, technological complements rise with income, but there's also considerable variations. So I've just marked US on the top, which is one of the countries obviously has very high level of technology adoption as well as complements. But you do see that there are massive variations. So many countries, low-income countries, have significant complement, much lower technology adoption. And there are many natural resource countries which have a lot more technology adoption and much less complements. This data set provides a simple diagnostic tool to prioritize policy for countries at different stages of development. So one of the things to note is while we have one dot for each country, it could be possible that a country might actually have very different stages in different sectors of the economy. So Kenya, mobile money could be actually a transforming sector in Kenya because they actually have to start dealing with some of the problems that mobile money creates, whereas their skills and the digital adoption by people might be at a emerging stage. So within a country, you could actually have a whole host of different typology that can be possible. So let me quickly move to the policy. So we use that broad typology that I just showed you in the final three chapters of the report to talk about what to do, where, and when. So we divide the policy into three chapters: the implication of the ICT sector itself, so that those are the sectoral priorities. The second is the national priorities, where we talk about complementary factors in terms of regulation, skills, and institutions. And finally, because internet crosses borders and requires global cooperation, we look at some of those issues that we need to tackle to get the maximum digital dividends. So I'll go fairly quickly on this. So the ICT policies that ensure that everyone will get affordable internet access is a pretty important goal, and we need to achieve that. This gets us back to the picture or the cover photo that I mentioned. These are the people holding up the mobile phones and migrants from Somalia who are straining to catch a signal from the country they came from, which is Somalia, because ICT prices or telecom prices in Somalia is much cheaper than in Djibouti, despite the fact that Somalia is a post-fragile country. But as you see, they have seven operators, and Djibouti has a public sector monopoly. So these are the people, even if they live in Djibouti, they're trying to see if they can catch the signal from Somalia so they can make a cheap call back home. So in terms of supply-side policies, we have a fairly good idea of what is required. Strong competition policy in the telecom sector, public-private partnership, effective telecom and internet market regulation. The private sector will make most of the ICT infrastructure investment, but public sector will sometimes be justified by strong social benefits from internet access. When it comes to the second issue, which is much harder, the demand-side policies or the second-generation policies, frankly, we don't have a really great ideas and solution to this, but we do talk about the problems. We provide a lot of information and data to have a more vigorous debate about how do you deal with issues of personal privacy, cybersecurity, and censorship and content filtering. And this picture just illustrates how the worldview on privacy has changed in the last 10 years. So then let's talk about national priorities. There are many practical steps that countries can take to strengthen the analog complements. How to adopt regulations, skills, and institutions to the digital age at different stages of digital development. So if you are in an emerging context, the internet use is still fairly low. The priority should be to build the foundation mostly by making adoption easier. If you are in the transitioning context, that's where we need to ensure that everyone is able to take advantage of new technology. And if you're in a transforming context where the internet use is already very high, the need is to address the wicked problems that the internet itself creates, such as complex competition and antitrust issues, and deepening the government digital engagement with citizens. So in a sense, what we're saying is the first one is adoption, the second is absorption, and third is mitigation. The final policy chapter deals with global issues, how to govern the global internet, and how to remove barriers to digital single market. One important aspect is how institutions such as World Bank, and perhaps to some extent Brookings, can better leverage these technologies to improve their own functioning and become more efficient in doing what they're doing. If the internet disrupts everything, should it not also disrupt the business of development? We hope the report, and you'll see a lot of discussion on this, will start a more vibrant debate about this topic with our development partners. So now let me conclude saying what's the big message in the report. And I think I've said enough of that you would have guessed it, but we're saying connectivity is important, but connectivity plus complement is what gives you the digital dividend. So one of the important messages is that digital development strategy need to be much broader than ICT strategies. Connectivity for all remains a hugely important goal and a tremendous challenge, but we need to do more. So let me go back to the three examples I started with. Safaricom was able to roll out mobile money because of rapid spread of cell phones in Kenya, but also because regulators, especially the central bank, allowed it to compete directly with banks. Alibaba's success builds on fast-rising internet coverage, but equally due to many skilled entrepreneurs, and Mr. Meng that I showed in the picture is actually an engineer before he became disabled, so he had many of the skills that you need to be successful in digital economy, aided by a supportive business environment, including good logistics. And India's digital ID system relies on large database and fast communication, but it cannot be an effective tool for service delivery to poor and disadvantaged people without accountable policymakers and service providers at all levels of government. But you might say, after all these long discussions, you're telling me the same old story that's about regulation, skills, and institutions, which is going to make, deliver digital dividends. So what's new about this? I think there are two big things that are new here. The first is that technologies are going to amplify the returns to traditional reforms. So we always did education reform because that increases your return on education, but technology is now going to increase the return on education because it amplifies the ability of the workers to do more. So clearly, if you are doing good policies, you get higher return. If you're doing bad policies, you actually get worse return. So in a sense, the failure to reform means falling further behind. So the risk-reward in the development business has dramatically shifted because of technology. The second is, while technology is not a shortcut to development, they can be an accelerator. Because now we can use technology to improve our competitiveness, increase the accelerated way to get skills formation, and to improve our institutions. So in a sense, we think that technology is not going to act as a shortcut in the sense you don't need those things and technology alone will take you there. But what technology can do is it can help you to form those complements much faster, which will give you the final dividend. So what the report proposes is that when these complements to digital investment are absent, the development impact of new technology will often be disappointing. But when technology builds strong analog foundation, they will harvest ample digital dividends, faster growth, more jobs, and better services. Thank you very much for your attention.
Well, thank you for your patience, everyone. Deepak, that was wonderful. I'm going to ask you a quick question. Before I do, I'm going to quickly tell you what a stunning panel we have here. I think you have the bios on your pieces of paper, so I'm not going to read them out. But we have here Susan Leung from McKinsey. I think you probably all know that the McKinsey Global Institute does really some of the best work on understanding the impact of the digital economy. He also does a lot of work in Africa. We have Jonathan Donner, who's the research director at Caribou, which is a really interesting little outfit based out of London, but really seems to be sort of based nowhere. Does really interesting, I'd say, sort of pioneering research on digital opportunities for developing countries. And we have Christina Sass, who's the co-founder of Andela. I'm not going to tell you too much about Andela, you may already know, because I want Christina to describe it to you in a minute. It's a great panel, and I'm going to deny them all a chance to speak while I ask Deepak one quick question. I warned Deepak beforehand that I was going to at least have one go to at demolishing the framework in the World Development Report, and we'll see how you handle my question. So I've read the overview many times. I've read other parts of the report, and I really enjoy the presentation, and it leaves me a little bit depressed. And the reason it leaves me depressed is that I look at that slide, looking at the correlation between the strength of the analog complements and the extent of adoption of digital technologies. And I see the US up at the top. And when I follow the domestic discussions here about the drop-off in productivity and the concerns about employment, I hear these sort of same kind of concerns that we're not getting digital dividends, we're not getting sufficient digital dividends. And when I think back to my WDR of 2011 on conflict, the work by Lamp Pritchett and Michael Walcock and others said, developing countries, it can take 100 years to build those analog complements, to build those institutions and so forth. So even if developing countries in 100 years end up with a quality of institutions of, say, the US, they're going to end up with the same kind of disappointment the US has today. Is that right?
No, I don't think so. So let me first say why you're not. First thing is that some of the disappointment comes from the fact that you drank the Kool-Aid, that technology is going to solve the problem. And we are saying, of course, there's a lot of hype on this. And some of this is true. I mean, we see transformational effect of technology in as I said, the story in China, India, and Kenya, and all over the world. So every country you go to, there's inspiring stories about how in the most fragile situation, technology is able to turn around things. But the question is, these are anecdotes. And what you want is you want a flow of systematic evidence that this is actually happening all over the place. And it's going to take time. So to me, the problem in developing countries and the developed countries are slightly different contexts. But on average, I think the developing countries have very little to lose in the next 10 years or 15 years, because the more technology that they take in, and I think in many cases they have the right complements, or a fairly large percentage of the firms, people, and government have the complements, so they should be able to get more dividends. But then when it comes to richer countries who are at the frontier of technological revolution, for them to continue to leapfrog or to continue to gain, they have to deal with the wicked problems that technology creates. So I think the nature of the problem facing Kenya versus US are very different, or India and US are very different, and each has to struggle to solve that problem. But I don't think that would necessarily mean, so we went to 22 countries and nobody has said that because of the fact that people in US are saying, oh, what has technology brought us, that I don't want to go there. In fact, there is super enthusiasm that we can do it. But yes, by the time we reach to a $40,000 per capita income, we'll find a way to solve that problem.
Okay. All right. Well, I tried. Susan, you've done some really interesting work at the Institute on what you describe as digital flows. So normally when we think of globalization, we think of flows of trade, of capital, of people, a little bit of people. But you come up with this new category of digital flows, and you assess, you look at how countries do in terms of how competitive they are, how engaged they are in digital flows. Can you explain a little bit about what digital flows are and how developing countries perform in terms of their engagement with these digital flows, as I said, but also are the constraints to engaging with digital flows the same analog foundations which Deepak's describing, or are there other things we should be concerned about?
Well, first of all, let me compliment Deepak and his team on a wonderful report. It is truly very thoughtful. It's a rich document that's going to be useful for many people for many years to come. One thing that we look at is cross-border data flows. We've looked at globalization now for several years, and one of the things you see very clearly in the data is that the last era of globalization seems to be over. When we look at global trade in goods, they fell sharply in 2009, had some rebound in 2010, and have been essentially flat and even growing more slowly than global GDP, as slow as that is, since 2010. We look at what's driving this. It was same with financial flows, down very sharply, not likely to regain their 2007 peak due to a sharp drop-off in intrabank type of flows for many, many years. And so this has led many pundits to say, well, globalization is stalled. It's over. We have protectionist sentiment, given that we've had slow economic growth in all the advanced economies and now many emerging economies and China as well. So this means the great phase of globalization we saw is over. We think of it very differently. We believe actually we're entering a new phase that we call digital globalization. That it's true that there are both cyclical and structural reasons that global trade has flattened in growth and may in fact never regain the robust growth that we saw for the last 20, 25 years. But what is exploding is cross-border flows of information. So this is taking the digital dividends that Deepak was talking about within an economy and thinking about the cross-border connections. In general, emerging economies have far lower cross-border data flows. In Africa, for instance, the submarine cable that circles a continent, you know, is a relatively new phenomenon. Broadband infrastructure has a long way to go inland from there. But what it opens up is new possibilities. So now if you are, say, a young person in Kenya and you know some computer coding, you can go on a platform like freelancer.com and be working for a European or U.S. company doing freelance work without ever leaving home. If you are a startup in Lagos, you can get funding from Kickstarter.com. We profile a South African med tech company that has a new app for diabetes management that got funding from abroad, mentors from abroad, and now sells to a global market. So what it's opening up the possibility is for people in low-income countries to participate directly and immediately in opportunities to work, to learn, to showcase their talent. We have a report on all of this coming out, as it happens, tomorrow. So feel free to visit our website and download it.
And if we want to see developing countries being even more successful in engaging these cross-border flows, is it analog foundations? And is it also the infrastructure you were talking about? This is your framework with the sectoral policies, national policies, right? Is that right?
I'm an economist by training. I would never say that all countries don't need more competition, skills, accountability, and transparency in governance. These things are clearly critical. And digital technologies are not a silver bullet for emerging economies to move up the income ladder. That said, what's amazing to me is how, despite all the barriers to doing business and despite the lack of skills, how when you do provide internet access or mobile access to people in emerging markets, there are those entrepreneurs that jump in despite all odds and set up, for instance, in Lagos, you can have food delivery service. Their first barrier of that company was to say, well, we don't know where people live. There's no white page directory. So when somebody orders their meal, how do we know where they live? Well, because of GPS on their phone, they know. So there are now startups in Lagos that probably have a more complete directory of people's names and addresses than the government itself. So I'm a full believer in analog complements, but I would never say wait for those. And maybe one quick last note on your question. Why don't we see the digital benefits? Where are the digital dividends in the U.S.? One part of the answer is we're measuring the wrong thing. When you think about the digital internet in the U.S., a lot of the benefit so far has been in unpriced consumer surplus. We simply don't capture that in the way we measure GDP. Think about, for most of you, have a smartphone in your pocket. Your smartphone that you spent a couple hundred bucks on replaces, at least for me, a camera. It replaces many books and magazines and physical copies that I bought. It replaces a boombox or mobile music system. It replaces a GPS system that we used to put on the dashboard of our car. All those purchases I no longer make because I spend a couple hundred bucks on a smartphone. the way we measure GDP, that just went down. But my welfare as a person went way up.
Okay, and that's presumably true maybe to a lesser extent in the developing world too, right?
Absolutely. Yeah,
right. So, Jonathan, one of the early slides from Deepak when he turned from the optimistic to the pessimistic, there was that different sort of transition in the slides. Deepak talked about all the people who don't have a cell phone, who aren't using the internet. One of the numbers which I found really striking in the WDR says that something like 40% of the world, the developing world, or the whole 40% of the entire world are using the internet. 10% of the world don't have access to the internet. And that leaves half the world who have access, at least it seems like, you know, they have the potential to be using the internet, and they're just not. So what's going on? What are those 3.5 billion people doing? What's making them decide not to use the internet?
Well, even in the by the way, again, thanks for having me. It's great to participate in this, and it's a fantastic report. It's completely, it's got generating all sorts of new ideas for me, and I'm grateful to have had the chance to engage with you guys on it. I think in that middle kind of band between, you know, there's these internet haves who, you know, everybody's got probably more than one device per person out there, and, you know, always on broadband connections at home, and, you know, we drink this thing from, we drink bits from a tap like it's never going to stop. And we have no problem at all with it. And then on the other extreme, there are hundreds of millions of people who don't live under a cell signal, and we have profound, entrenched challenges ahead of us in getting access to those people to even begin to solve the first-order digital divide questions. In the middle, there are these internet behaviors, these internet practices, internet sort of digital days that don't look like our digital days very much. And that's one thing to have to understand. Even if you've got a cell phone, even if you've got a smartphone, if all you have is a 3G connection and you pay by the bit, your internet is not our internet. And what's funny, the slide you showed, the beautiful picture of the images of everybody holding up their cell phones, is a price signal, right? I mean, they're reacting to a sort of an artificial signal where prices are higher here or not. But that's because people are incredibly price sensitive, right? And when every bit counts, the decision on the margin about whether to consume or not, whether to click or not, whether to leave your little WebMD app running to monitor your heart and make you healthy or not, maybe not. And that's a challenge we need to get to, we need to resolve. And it's going to start to show the strains of, and I'll finish this up soon, but it's going to start to show the strains of the promise I think that we've all been embracing around mobile. Mobile's been great to get some sort of internet out, or at least some sort of possible internet out, to almost everybody who lives under a cell phone tower. Mobile's not going to be the solution as we see it now. The mobile as we experience it now is not going to be the thing that allows everybody to participate in the same internet that we participate in. And I would even say that's the Odesk workers and everything like that. If you've got to pay by the bit, how much are you going to do? You know, there's a lot of work to be done there. But then people also may just decide not to go online because, there's nothing there for them. But I think that the social media companies are doing a pretty good job finding something for almost everybody.
Okay, so you think the price is especially important?
I do.
Right. And so is that one of the things I've heard is this issue of local content.
Yeah.
That in a lot of places in the world, you know, if you speak a language which there are no app developers, you know, speaking that language, there's nothing for you there.
Yeah.
Is that a kind of a real minority issue? There's the price, and then there's the, you know, just the whole content quality concern.
So I'm going to make two adjustments on each of those words. Yeah. On price, it's not just the absolute price and measured as a, you know, kind of proportion of your household income, but actually how it's built. The experience at every single moment of living in a prepay mindset or a metered mindset changes how one interacts with the internet. And I don't think we give that enough credit when we talk about a more mobile internet.
Jonathan, you haven't even been very good about not plugging stuff. So I want to say one thing, which is, I'm not going to talk about your book just now. I'm going to talk about a recent report which Caribou did, which looked at which tried to illustrate digital days of young Kenyans with very modest daily incomes.
Yep.
And how what devices they're using, what connections they're using, and what they're doing with their digital days, right?
Yeah.
What apps, which is really fascinating work. Do you want to comment on that at all?
I must. Thank you very much. It's very kind. But I think that the way to tie that back to your question is, what constitutes the most of the digital day?
Yeah.
Better for better or for worse, it begins with an F, you know, and it's Facebook, right? And or it's in places where Facebook isn't the number one social network. It's whatever, you know, in China, it'd be whatever networks are du jour in China, right? But social networking delivers all that local content, which seems so hard to generate through centralized means, right? As long as the language systems support other people interacting with each other, and as long as people have the language skills to participate in a web that's still, you know, it's less so every day, but still requires text, then I'm not as worried about the local content draw.
Right.
I'm worried about getting people's primary internet connection sufficiently affordable that they perceive that they can use it for each next click. And mostly that's mobile, but that's also free Wi-Fi, and that's computer centers and all these other, that's satellites and drones and balloons and such.
Fina, you've been really patient. I want you to just briefly describe what Andela does, because you're providing people in Nigeria, I think also in South Africa, maybe some other countries, so maybe that's on the horizon, a chance to do much more than just access Facebook by harnessing the digital opportunities. So can you just briefly describe what Andela does, because it's probably the coolest idea I've heard of how you can use the digital technology for the purpose of development.
Thank you, Lawrence. So Andela is seeking out the top tech talent in Africa. We're looking for passion and drive. We're screening thousands and thousands of applicants, mostly because we pay people to train and retrain in the most needed digital technologies on the global marketplace. And that's both on the technical side and also on the soft skills side, which I want to get into. We're building them into technologists that it's a full-fledged career, not just in the nuts and bolts technologies. So we're screening for talent and drive, and then we retrain, help them to level up in the most needed technologies, and then we place them full-time as full-time remote workers in companies all over the world. So we have clients in the U.S., on the West Coast and the East Coast. We have clients in London. We have clients in Lagos, and are about to have clients in Kenya as well. And so they are not outsourced workers. They are incredible problem solvers. It's a new model for integrated workforces that's, you know, it's recognizing talent wherever it is and revaluing that talent wherever it is.
So this seems to address lots of different development problems. It seems to address the skills shortage, the sort of the job matching concern, the sort of the trying to create a more kind of level global playing field. The need for new kinds of new skills and sort of the new economy. You're a pioneer in this. You know, this is still fairly early days. What's your vision? What does this look like? Not when Andela is at full scale, but when you have lots of people copycatting what you're doing or building similar things. And how far does this go? These sorts of approaches in terms of solving what are fundamentally big failures, right? Of education institutions, of the job market, and so forth.
Well, I'll start with the bottom line up front. We, you know, in terms of global employment, I mean, we believe that if young people are going to put their time and effort into a four-year commitment, especially one that they pay for, if it does not end in a career path, they should get their money back. So we want to flip that model on its head and say, if you're extraordinary and you're willing to dive in and give it your all, and, you know, then something should absolutely prepare you for a market where there's, you know, a job for you. How far can this go? So, you know, I know we're going to get into all of this. It's extraordinarily difficult to provide this in Lagos and in Nairobi right now, mostly because of the cost of broadband access and of the level of training needed to really compete on the global marketplace. So the technical skills and aptitude it's really just the beginning. I can tell you stories all day of people trading in their lunch money for access to be able to train on the tech stack that they think is best. But if anyone here has ever worked with software developers, they're no different in Lagos than anywhere else, where they need soft skills and they need, the business skills to be able to really, work cross-culturally as much as anyone else, to remove the big headphones and learn to actually solve a problem with a team that's on a deadline. And so that's, So if we can address those, if we can address those pieces, then we, you know, we believe that the capacity for growth is massive, and we would encourage copycats in doing this. Nice. Right now we're in Lagos and in Kenya. We have just about 160 people in Lagos and 40 in Kenya, and then adding about eight software developers every month. And so, you know, we have the possibility, we're going to build slowly in maybe the next year, and then hope to expand potentially into Ghana, into South Africa, into regional hubs that recruit from all over. And so the long-term goal for our technologists is to, one, be able to compete, to be able to be the leading technologists in their field, and then train them once they graduate. We're a four-year program. We want them to graduate into governance, into CTO and, you know, leading engineer roles, and also to help us, you know, build this model and then build their own companies, right, to be entrepreneurs. And so the goal is for them to help to make growth equitable across the continent. And without cutting-edge leading technologists that are African, we won't do that. So we would love and encourage more people to be doing this.
Okay, that's great to hear of a tech pioneer who's asking people to copycat them.
Just the training.
Susan, I want to bring you in again here, because I know you've done some work looking at both what you perceive to be the efficiency gains in terms of job matching through digital job platforms, and also the demand for skills in the future. So there's a sort of a mismatch between where the kind of jobs that are going to be needed and the kind of skills we currently have. So could you relate that to this brilliant Andela model?
Well, I'm fascinated by Andela, and I'm so glad that you exist, and I hope many people copycat you. There is tremendous opportunity for emerging markets, for talented individuals within low-income countries, I think, to leapfrog ahead and tap directly into global marketplace. But you do need the skills. Now, the digital platforms exist, so without being part of Andela, you can actually, if you have skills, you can go on to many different global platforms, freelancer.com. What used to be Odesk is now called Upwork.com. There are a growing number of places where largely people in low-income countries are finding work from companies in high-income countries. One of the interesting things is that that flow is now starting to reverse. You have large Chinese and Indian companies hiring freelancers in the U.S. and in Europe for different sales and marketing, more localized content. So you see these flows of labor crisscrossing the world. So in that way, we think digital platforms are part of an answer. Maybe to Deepak's point, this isn't going to lift every poor person out of you know, poverty. This is about giving people with talent and a reasonable primary and secondary education an opportunity to find employment that they are not finding locally, and they're finding that they can earn more money and have better incomes. At the same time, there is an opportunity even within emerging markets to really open up some of the inefficiencies and lack of transparency in labor markets. So traditionally, somebody goes to an employer, you signal your quality with maybe where you went to school, the degree you earned, maybe your grades, maybe you have a personal connection with someone at the company. But it's a very, very crude signal of what you can do. Now, with either online job boards or sites like LinkedIn, you can post incredible detail about what you are able to do. You can post books that you've written, reports. You can get endorsements from colleagues who talk about not only your hard skills but your soft skills. For employers, this means that you can do a much better job of seeing what this person has to offer and hiring to meet your own needs. There's now a whole slew of companies that are actually doing away with this sort of resume approach and go directly by scraping information about all of you from around the web, what you're doing on social media, your employment history, your education history, and putting together profiles and then actively going after a certain person.
So Christina, I think, either really agreed or disagreed with something you just said.
Well, you told us to jump in.
I did.
So I will not discount that a lot of people are finding that kind of work on Freelancer and Upwork. But what we're finding is that it doesn't level people up. When we talk about dividends, when we talk about catapulting people's ability and, you know, for these emerging economies to build the robust tools that are really needed to roll things out, we don't see that happening on those platforms. I'll give you an example. You talked about the food delivery service in Lagos. So without naming names, a lot of the major, like, rapidly growing technology companies in Lagos outsource their software developers. That's tragic because that talent is extraordinary. And when I say extraordinary, I mean we've had 27,500 applicants. Christina Sass would not make it into Andela as an applicant. They are crazy smart, but the local, you know, the education systems there aren't training for it. And the companies that are there are, I don't blame them. They should not stop their growth because the technology isn't there, but somebody has got to, you know, get in there and really, really fill that gap to be able to level people up to, you know,
right,
grow the dividends that we want.
You, Jonathan, are you chomping now?
Sorry.
Let's finish off on that.
Yeah.
I think that one thing that's interesting to sort of join these two discussions a bit is not all flows are, you know, they're not all the same, and sort of your position relative to the flows, to use some sociological perspectives on it, helps determine whether these flows work for you or against you, you know. And, you know, I think about, you know, this is an example, this idea of being able to work for somebody who really is willing to pay you, who's 5,000 miles away, is an example of a flow working for you.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a taxi driver in Nairobi, and now Uber is reconfiguring that industry, and that's a flow. I mean, I don't know where the Uber server sits that actually determines the ride for something in Kenya, but I know that 30% of that fee goes to Silicon Valley, right? And that's a strange thing to have happen to something that was a local market, that was a geographically defined, you know, regional service done by people for a long time. Food delivery, you know, you get the tiwalas or something in the corner shop somewhere in any one of 1,000 towns in India, where I'll bet that Yelp and Google Maps and everybody else knows where that tiwala is and whether the tea is good or not, even if the tiwala person themselves doesn't know that data exists about them.
Interesting.
And that's a big challenge, right? So the literacy challenge of getting everybody skilled up to be able to participate in whatever structures are kind of in whatever flows are hitting them is a big problem.
You want to jump?
Yeah, two points. One is, look, it is a global marketplace. It is tragic that startups in Lagos are going to Upwork to hire computer programmers probably in Bangladesh or India. It is suddenly a global marketplace, which I think underscores one of Deepak's points, which is there is a risk of countries and individuals getting left further behind if they can't compete in this new world.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, it also underscores, I think, to the second point, this issue about the price of all of this and can you afford to actually participate in the global opportunities because you're paying so much for bits of data you can't, you know, afford to either work or take courses or avail yourself of the information, I think, is critical.
Deepak, I know you want to say something. We're going to come to the audience in about 5 minutes, but just before we do, I know you had something that you wanted to say, but whatever you wanted to say, I want to tag on one more question. So what... one of the things which I heard from Jonathan and Christina is that, you know, the infrastructure is still pretty, you know, pretty weak, pretty poor in a lot of developing countries. This is a public good issue. And a lot of developing countries, public goods are underprovided. And one of the purposes of foreign assistance and kind of global philanthropy is to sort of try and sort of, you know, fill in some of those public goods. Is the World Bank going to start devoting serious money to, or is it already devoting serious money to sort of, you know, the capital goods, the other investments needed to provide the kind of infrastructure we want? And if it isn't going to be the World Bank, who should be doing this? Because there isn't, it's not, you know, at the moment I feel we're all kind of waiting for Mark Zuckerberg to pay for this, which is, you know, which is lovely, but it doesn't seem right. And he might not. And so who should be providing these public goods where developing country governments tend to underprovide those goods or provide them with very poor quality? Another easy question for Deepak.
I think this is the only place where you can say the world is waiting for Mark Zuckerberg to come in. I don't think anybody in Kenya, India, and China are waiting for Facebook to provide the infrastructure they lack. But I think to me, and we can get into the discussion of the World Bank, but I don't think we should, you know, that's a whole issue about what World Bank is doing and all that stuff. The World Bank has been doing it for 60 years about providing the analog foundation. But I think the whole idea is, how do you do it better? How do you improve it? So we have this whole chapter. It's a bit of a navel-gazing into the World Bank, saying we didn't want to talk too much because, like, we are the insiders. How can we be telling what the World Bank should be doing, and can we be credible? But we still do a little bit of it. So I'd urge you, if you're interested in this, to go into Chapter 6, Section 2, which talks about 10 pages of this, about what, how is GIVE directly disrupting the way, you know, aid is given to bottom billion, and is World Bank going to wake up to that and do things? So we can still do the roads, bridges, the schools, hospital, but do it much more differently. And there is a lot of discussion in the bank on this particular
thing. And ICT infrastructure too?
Yes, specifically. Absolutely. So there are, but I think the issue is, strangely in the bank, we have actually very little demand for connectivity projects. So our ICT unit is actually shrinking, because there's no, every world, at least as far as the fibers are connected, that problem has been solved. The first mile has been solved. Now it's the middle mile and the last mile where our ICT unit is not deep into it. But I just thought I'd give you what I really want to hear, what people have to say, but I'll just say one or two things. One is this thing that, the thing that Christina's shop is doing is exactly what we're saying is the analog foundation you need. But if you today read and listen to, people who are super enthusiastic of technology, they would basically say, you bring broadband to a village and we'll solve the gender problem, we'll solve the security problem, we'll solve employment problem. And by doing it, we are actually not just that it's not true, it's actually doing a disservice to the development business, because the politicians would say, so why do I need to do anything if technology will do anything? So in a sense, it actually saying if this is going to improve skills into this, it actually makes it almost as if these are replacing good policy institutions, and the policymakers say, I don't actually have to do much, and technology will do it, so it will be kind of quite devastating. Second is, when you're looking at a lot of this data flows and all the things, which are great, but if you really look behind what's the data, and I'll give you three statistics just to see, just because the data flow has become so dramatic and the cost of data is zero, or information is zero, so you're consuming a lot of it, but does it really mean it's leading to jobs, growth, and service delivery? So 40% of our digital consumption in US is Netflix. About 67% of emails are junk in the world. So the 2.7 billion emails I showed you, 67% are junk. And this is by Google. 30 to 40% of the trade, digital flows are pornographic material. So clearly, just because we have lots of data flow, so we've got to look more deeper into see what are these things doing and how. And I think those data flows are important, as Jonathan mentioned, that, the freelancers, the Uber. So these are super important, but we've got to be more nuanced. We've got to be more subtle to look at which are the ones we need to encourage, which are the ones which, market will determine its own fate.
I think we can all agree that pornography and junk mail are demerit goods, but Netflix I will defend. I want to go to the audience. The rules are, it'd be great if you could identify yourself. If you have an affiliation, you want to tell us that would be interesting to know. Have a question, if possible, and a relatively short one, if possible, too. That would be great. And I will take them in groups. So we have Madeline has a microphone and going to be running up and down the middle. So please raise your hand if you have questions. I have one, two, three. So I'm making it easy for Madeline. So start with the lady with the gray cardigan. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm Judy Payne from USAID. I'm the ICT advisor for agriculture. I'd say that agriculture sector is extremely important in the developing world. 80% of the poor in sub-Saharan Africa are farmers. Affordable access is a huge challenge and one that is being addressed by the World Bank and others. Do you have any other comments on or insights on progress we can make in agriculture?
Great question. Okay.
Hi, Nagi Hanna. First, congratulations on the report, mainly because, not just because of the quality, because of the fact that at the World Bank, it has been a very difficult process to get any research in this area. So this is in some way a breakthrough to have it as a WDR, recognizing that this is an important part of the development process. The main concern I have really is related to implementing, operationalizing the recommendations of the report. And here, I think there are major challenges. On the one hand, I don't think the access per se is the biggest problem, because I think a lot of that is being done by the private sector or through public-private partnerships. And the World Bank has been doing a lot of that in the past anyway. And many of the issues related to privatization, participation, and so on, in some way have been addressed or at least standardized. We know the prescriptions for that. The real problem, also the complement, to some extent, I would say, is the bread and butter of most aid agencies, especially in the World Bank. And there is really no controversy about the fundamentals there. So it's being practiced by most other projects. There is, however, a major gap, and I think the gap is also in the report, but is going to be a big challenge for implementation. And that is the fact that organizations, especially government and small and medium enterprises, face a major problems of learning to use information technology, not in terms of mobile, but systems, integration, doing business. These are capabilities that needs to be developed over time. And in a paradigm shift like this, technological paradigm, there is a lot of adjustment needed for business processes, for skills, for not just individual skills, but organizational learning and so on. And somehow I feel the report does not bring that across enough. Okay, and it is a major, major issue in my view. And it's a major issue for development agencies.
I think it's a very good point. And finally, did you have a question at the front?
Hi, thank you very much for speaking. My name is XY Lau. I'm a student at American University. And my question is, how do you see, I mean, because we think of China as being having a big impact on the digital world. So how exactly do you see China changing the digital development, or if anything, developing digitally in the near future and for far future as well? Thank you.
Okay, great. Deepak, I know some of these are for you, especially the second question. But I also think this second question about the kind of the capabilities. I'd love to hear Christina's take on that. So why don't I go to you first?
Is it possible to put some of the backup slides that I had sent out? No. Okay.
Start speaking. Yeah. Mic here.
Okay. So first thing I wanted to just say that, you know, this was 15-minute or 20-minute presentation, so there's a lot in the report, and you got to root. So we have 6 sector focus note on agriculture, energy, urbanization, health, education, and disaster risk management. So I really urge you to take a look at this. Just Google WDR 2016. It should be on top. And we also have what we call 5 digital enablers. So this is digital payment system, social media, digital ID, and digital open data, big and open data, digital data revolution. So these are more specifically getting into what we are doing in agriculture, what are the kind of things, and these are actually put together by the Agriculture Global Practice. So it's very interesting, and we try to take the same framework of inclusion, efficiency, and innovation, saying where technology is allowing us to get into newer areas or bring in new farmers, get into new kind of cultivation using digital technology, where we can help make existing farmers much more productive, link them to markets, you know, provide them the fertilizer at the right time, and a whole host of increasing efficiency. And then the whole digital, the innovation platform, where you are actually going to use real-time big data and all sorts of innovation that's happening to kind of improve productivity and all that stuff. So there are quite a bit of that on agriculture. The second question was on
the capabilities of firms to sort of use the digital technology and how hard it is to inculcate that.
So one of the things that I find very, you know, in some sense upsetting thing that, you know, we are so focused on how much people have access to it. So we have tons of data about how many individuals access internet, how many mobile phones, and all. Nobody has a good data on how many firms in developing countries have access to internet, how many are doing business online, how many are using RFID chips, how many are doing enterprise resource planning. Very little. The only countries and the only groups where you can find is OECDs, because OECD put together a good report on this. There's very little. So one of the things that we are really focused on saying, a lot of the benefits of digital technology will come when our businesses go to adopt it, when our firms. So the statistics is, even in OECD countries, only 15% of the firms are using clouds. And, you know, we talk about clouds as if, you know, everybody in the world has it. Of course, if you have a Gmail, you're using cloud, but people are, you know, in some sense, using it to pay and do the business. It's very little. 10% of the firms are actually doing online business. And then, so that relates to the question on China. And then you go to China. So China has this interesting phenomenon, which I'm sure all of you know about, they're called Taobao villages. Taobao is a local name for Alibaba. And so there's a villages where 10% of people, or the villages, are selling online. So once you have a village where 10% people start to sell online, you're declared as a Taobao village. And then a lot of the analog components come in. So there are villages with 40 logistic companies. There are Taobao universities which are helping entrepreneurs to say, how do you do product placement? You know, there are 400,000 women who are posing with products on the on online screen. So these are all the analog foundation that the Alibaba has created, because they realize that you need the two things to come together. So to us, so I think the countries which are able to bring the technology as well as, you know, provide that kind of support, and it's amazing how much so one of the things that we find is, if you go to India, the largest education institution in India is not a university, it's actually Infosys, which is the third largest or second largest IT company, because they are finding a lot of kids who come out of colleges do not have the kind of skills that would easily turn them to coder. So they are, you know, they have created an assembly line of people who are coming in and getting educated. If you go to, you know, China, Taobao has, or Alibaba has become a huge place for, you know, getting all those vocational skills. And eBay has its own thing which has started. So I think those, unless we start to track how much our firms are, you know, online, what are they doing, you know, just have basic statistics, facilitate that process of more digital adoption. So if you look at our adoption between business people and government, we find in Africa, the business are really behind. Less than 5% of firms are online, whereas, of course, 80% of people are online, or, you know, not 80, 40%. And governments have invested massively in many of these countries. So clearly the focus has been completely upside down. I would say the biggest focus in many of the low-income countries has to be to get how should we get the businesses online, but not by in a supply-driven, subsidized policy, but to have more demand-based solutions. So how do you get more competition so that firms will always look for new ways to remain competitive, and digital technology provide the solution?
On this issue of firm capabilities, and I think one of the most compelling explanations I've seen of the drop-off in productivity in the US is the variance in the adoption of technology among firms. I'd love to hear your view on that. I'd also love to hear your view, Susan, on China. But before I do, can I quickly go to Christina just to ask a little bit about what the kind of skills which your Silicon Valley kind of partners are looking for. I remember hearing you speak last summer, Christina, where you describe people who are graduating from universities in Nigeria in computer programming, and they've never spent a day doing coding. So I'd love to hear a bit more about exactly what kind of skills are being demanded by, this is, you know, Western firms, and sort of the kinds of, you know, you mentioned soft skills briefly earlier, but if you could expand a little bit, that would be fascinating.
Sure. So, yes, we do see a lot of even extraordinary young people that have gone through a four-year degree program that have maybe basic JavaScript, maybe who have learned most of their computer science degree program from books and really not had. So we have to get the tools, the right tools out there. When we talk about implementing and the barriers to access, so we're making great strides, but it is extraordinarily resource intensive and labor intensive to provide a real work environment where people can reap digital dividends. So just to put some numbers around that. So in Lagos, we pay just under $10,000 a month, and we are right on the fiber cable in Yaba. And so that's not off the grid in some place where it's, you know, less expensive to operate. We're right where the government did invest in the fiber cable. And so in Kenya, it's about $4,000 a month. That's $160,000 US dollars a year. That's for 200 people. total, and that's about $800 a person. So when we talk about people that are really off the grid, and that is you know, higher than most per capita income in African countries. So it's still incredibly expensive to really get that access. And what we also see is that there's extraordinary tools out there to train. They need to be low bandwidth. We need to really, most 90% of people in and around Lagos cannot access video, which is, you know, a huge part of a lot of the trainings that are out there. And so we're trying to repackage and get all kinds of information out there such that people that are great at this, that are driven, that want to do it can kind of, you know, can naturally rise up. So we're trying to find ways to offer, to get, you know, get low bandwidth training out there to see, you know, kind of who bubbles up. But we need other people to come in and really, really offer that. So in terms of what companies want, it's no different from what, you know, any of you are looking for in an extraordinary employee. They're, you know, great problem solvers, flexible. We have to have overlapping time. They have to overlap with regular working hours and be able to instant message, you know, do stand-ups and thus have video conferencing and all of these things. So we've doubled, tripled down on soft skills, meaning one full month at the beginning of the program where we say, pause on your technology training stack, and now we're going to talk about when there's a problem, when you're not going to deliver this on time, how you communicate that very, very, very clearly to an employer. So that, you know, has increased. And then, you know, even the broadband width, sorry, going back to it, we've had clients that have threatened to drop our services just because it's cut off, just because technology, you know, the internet cuts off in the middle of a call. And I can't tell you, it's frustrating at any point in time, but when you pay $10,000 a month for internet and you're on a client onboarding call to have the generator, you know, go out and there's a long, annoying beep, and then it takes about 30 seconds for the inverter to kick in. I mean, these, you know, the environment in which we operate is absolutely critical, and obviously we can't solve all those on our own, so it's very resource intensive to be able to compete. And so companies need to plan for that up front. What is it going to take to really offer complete broadband and guarantee that their technologist is going to be there when the company needs it, no matter where they are in the world?
Before I come to you, Jonathan is begging for a quick comment, is that right? No? Okay, Susan, go ahead.
We did research. The cost of broadband access in Lagos is 21 times the cost in London. So there is still a huge issue about affordable access, even if the physical access is there, getting it affordable. We just did a study looking at the U.S. economy on digitization of different businesses and industries. And the amazing thing is you might think of the U.S. as one of the countries on the digital frontier, but even here, across different sectors of the economy, there's startlingly different use of digital assets, talent, and business processes, with sort of ICT, finance, media, up on the top being most digitized, and then hospitality, agriculture, mining, healthcare being down on the bottom. And then within any industry, you can do the same chart of the leading companies that are heavily digitized in terms of their own business processes, their investments in ICT per worker, and their usage of digital assets compared to companies that aren't. So it's no different and probably worse in low-income countries, but this dispersion across companies occurs everywhere. And a big part of it, I think, is competition, affordable access. Maybe in low-income countries there's an additional information and training component about helping small businesses understand what the possibilities are if you set up a website and so on. So there may be, and that could be a public good provided by the World Bank or other philanthropy organizations, but a lot of it does come down to competition, and are you pressured to keep up with what, you know, the business next door is doing?
Okay, let me go back to the audience. I'm going to take the lady over here, the lady at the back who's outstanding, and I'm going to take this gentleman here.
Hi, my name is Rebecca Saxon-Fox. I work for USAID in the U.S. Global Development Lab. My question's for Christina. I'm interested to know how, if any of your software engineers are ending up in the public sector, and if so, I guess why, and if not, why? Like, how can we're working on this in the U.S. as well. How do you incentivize good people to go into the public sector rather than the higher-paying private sector?
Great question. Tough question.
Hi, my name is Judith Helosine. My question is about, I actually have two questions. One is digital literacy, and there's a one of the problems that you talk about, the analog components, is a very much lack of digital literacy by the population. They don't even know what ICT is. They think ICT is equipment or IT. They have little knowledge of what is internet. And also there's a lack of by a will of the government, because they've been using that lack of knowledge to lord it over the citizens. And so the information is power, but the information is not getting to the people. And so that is just one question. And the second one is, what happens when countries don't have the political will, or the from the president on down, if they don't understand ICT, they don't understand the impact, then it's very difficult to get anything started. And so I would like some of those.
Great. Thank you for that. I need to get to the front.
Hi, Stefan Pagura with the United Nations Economic Commission of Latin America and the Caribbean. Super long title. my question to the panel is, if you guys have thought about the way that digital technology can work in refugee situations, and whether or not, you know, thought has been given to how we can ensure that whole generations don't fall behind, especially as, you know, that they hopefully will re-enter economies where it is possible to connect to the global market, and how we can work to ensure that they're not lagging.
Great. Refugees. Okay, so I'm going to start with Jonathan, and I'm going to slightly spin this question about digital literacy to hear to allow you to speak a little bit about about political will. Sorry, allow you to speak a little bit about what has recently gone down in India and Egypt around free basics. So I think the Indian government would say they're a great advocate for internet use, but they are not allowing Facebook to provide a package of free services for limited internet access. Could you provide some comments on that? I know it's a dicey topic.
No, I think that the digital literacy question is an outstanding challenge, and that the understandings we have around literacies are lagging the technologies and the potential technologies themselves. So there is an analog component to get that up to speed and deployed at scale, definitely. On this question of sort of political will or the politicization of infrastructure or the delivery of the shape of the internet, I think one thing you can say about what happened in India, I don't know as much about the Egypt case, whether the same ruling went down or not, but in India, basically, Facebook rolled out a program which allowed individuals to access Facebook for free on their phones. And they dressed it up. They put it inside a little offering that included Facebook and some information if you're a farmer, and some good health information, and
BBC.
And a bunch of stuff that looked like what you would dream up if you sat around a conference table and crafted all the best sorts of greatest hits of M4D, mobiles for development, and put it all together and made it free. It was basically Facebook plus all these things around it, and they had deployed it in several countries, kind of without a lot of incident and just some take up and not a lot of evidence because not a lot of scrutiny. And then in India, just stuff went crazy. They got a million letters to online submissions back to the telecoms regulator there, with people largely protesting this program based on it being a violation of net neutrality, that not all bits are treated the same, and that sets up distortions in the marketplace, makes competition tough. Stop. And after a long pause, India's regulator said stop. And so in India, you can't price discriminate on bits over the mobile channel. What I think is interesting about that is it's a mobile question and only comes up. We only have this fight because now people have to pay by the bit, and it's because they have mobile and they don't have other means of internet access. But I think it can be nothing but good for the literacy conversations, no matter how you feel, particularly about protecting net neutrality in this case. And I'm kind of on the fence about it because it's nice to get internet when you have no internet and you can't afford to pay for it. You heard me say that earlier. But however you feel about the net neutrality issue, the fact that it sort of crossed over from being something you know, in rooms like this and kind of just people talking about what the shape of the internet might be, to being something that the public cared about, is pretty important, because that's going to be a part of everybody's society is increasingly constituted by their locations in these structural flows and these information flows, and the shape of those flows, which is determined by the algorithms and the shape of the software and the rules of the software platforms on which we are interacting, is something that every country has a stake right. in trying to make what is best for that country.
Interesting. So this big explosion has been good, at least for awareness, and people think about what digital literacy is. Christina, do you want to make a comment about public sector workers? I assume it's too soon for you to place anyone in the Nigerian government, but is it realistic that anyone who's got through, you know, the top 0.01% of your talent pool decides they want to become a civil servant? Is that ever going to happen?
It's a really great question. So we're 2 years into a four-year fellowship and thus have not graduated anyone out yet. But we are planning exit paths and the ones that I mentioned, entrepreneurship, helping us to build and scale Andela and other similar things, tech, you know, CTOs of companies, and then and governance. And so it's going to be a tough sell. People are looking at, you know, the hottest employers of other that are building, you know, the hottest tech products and things. And so we're deeply invested in them making growth equitable and looking at local solutions. That's a huge part of keeping tech talent right there where it is. And so we're already doing projects. We've done hackathons with, you know, Uber in Lagos and Hotels.ng. So looking at all kinds of different ways to support homegrown solutions. But this is going to be a tough sell, and we're already working on it. Two of our earliest fellows who are extraordinary leaders in our program, Sheyun Martins and Tolu Kamolafe. I refer to them as Minister Martins and Minister Kamolafe for this very reason. We've had great support from Minister Johnson, former minister in Lagos, to help spread. And they've done lots of different efforts to get people on Upwork and on freelance. And they, you know, have helped us spread applications and spread the word. But it's hugely important. It's going to be, you know, when we look at we need a tipping point of people in governance that have exposure to cutting edge technologies, and that think of the equitable spread of it as a great career path. And so I think there will be a very small subset, and I think they will be critical at transforming the sector. So we're hoping if Andela can get, if we can get four or five, of those in the next, you know, 4 years or so, I'll be thrilled that
this is not just a problem for digital skills. You know, all the great African economists who go to graduate school in the U.S. really end up back at the National Statistics Office in Nigeria or anywhere else. I want to give Deepak a chance to talk about refugees. Did you look at this at all?
Unfortunately, not. There is a bit of a discussion on natural disaster management and how technology can help, but not so much into refugee situation. If at all, we have a positive story about how, in terms of it helps. So Somalia is one of the most wired country in the world in its neighborhood, and largely because they have a large number of migrants out. So everybody in Somalia knows how to use the internet and mobile phone because they have to connect to the rest of the world. So in a sense, there are a lot of positive stories, but we don't really get into this issue, so I won't
There was this greater survey done by the IRC, which asked what were the first questions refugees asked when they arrived in Greece, and it was, one, where can I get free Wi-Fi, and two, where can I plug in my phone?
One is the issue of digital literacy, but I just want to tell you that, you know, you also have to think, not just, you know, digital literacy is a huge issue and we need to work on it, but just the normal literacy. So the statistic is 22% of the adults in the world can't read and write. So what do you do with mobile phone and internet? So clearly we have to address, and there's a massive surge among those people who couldn't read and write to be now want to read and write because now they want to use a mobile phone. So they finally realized the benefit of literacy. And so as organization, we should be facilitating that process. And the second is when it comes to accountability, I mean, the question that was asked was, is there really, you know, there are lots of government who just do not want massive internet penetration in the countries. So Kenya and Ethiopia sit next to each other. you know, Kenya has 45% internet penetration, Ethiopia has 2%. I used to live in Ethiopia for 3 years, and I used to pay $1,000 a month to access 256 kbps internet. Right? So there's a reason why you know, Ethiopia has been very reluctant to do it. You know, it's based on their own national discussion. But there are governments who are unwilling to provide that. So I'll leave you with one example. So Estonia is a very wired country. 3,000 of the services, public services, are online. You can start a business in Estonia in minutes. You can file your taxes in seconds. At least that's what they claim. So the Estonia government was trying to provide some of the services to many of the Central Asian countries, saying we have this, you know, good service. The programs and codings are freely available. Come and take it. And we'll, of course, charge few amounts for some technical assistance. And so the Tom Elvis, the president of Estonia, said this. So there's one country which came and they studied everything. And then they decided, we like your police module a lot because then we can track everybody inside the country. So they went and implemented only one part of the Estonian X Road, which is about how do you track people more closely. And it was authoritarian dictatorial regime. So clearly it's the same technology, but it depends on accountability, which is exactly why. So it's the information plus accountability gives you wonderful stuff. Information minus accountability gives you state control and elite capture.
Well, on that very smart note, we're going to wrap up. We've run over by about 5 or 6 minutes, but I think it was worth it because we've got such a great panel here. Before I let you applaud them, I just want to do a plug for everyone on this stage. So you've all got to go and read Deepak's World Development Report, obviously, and you'll all be tested on it next week, all 300 pages. Don't forget Susan's new report coming out tomorrow. Jonathan's book, After Access, which I've been reading last night. It's actually a really wonderful read. I encourage you all to have a look. He was very good to say about not plugging it, but it speaks a lot of the issues we've been talking about today, especially people's experience of the internet entirely through mobile phones. And finally, you've all got to go and look more at what Andela's doing, because it really is, I think, quite a transformational. Thank you so much, everyone, for coming.